Greetings, everyone, and welcome to the Law Hour and Editorial Review. The Law Hour is sponsored by Gordon Law School of Isabella, Missouri. The Law Hour is an educational service in the public interest. I'm your narrator, George Gordon. The Law Hour and Editorial Review is heard nationally 7 days a week here in the United States and in more than 75 countries around the world over the Internet. For more information about the Law Hour and Editorial Review, please visit our webpage at georgegordon.org. Again, that's georgegordon.org. Now, the Law Hour and Editorial Review brings you important information about law, news, and current events. So stay tuned for tonight's special report on Israel's tribes today, right after this. Justice William O. Douglas made this observation one time. He said, "Those who already walk submissively will say that there's no cause for alarm. But submissiveness is not our heritage. The First Amendment was designed to allow rebellion to remain as our heritage, and the Constitution was designed to keep government off the backs of the people. The Bill of Rights was added to keep the precincts of belief and expression, of the press, of political and social activities, free from government surveillance." I wish I'd have thought of that, but that quotation came from Supreme Court Justice William O. Douglas. Now, our princes and our politicians beller in the halls of Congress for more taxes, more spending, and more gun control. But you and I haven't heard anything intelligent come out of a politician's mouth in more than 75 years now, have we? That's why I contend that the only real reason, logic, or common sense left in America comes from our courts, not from the political process, not from the politicians, not from the lawyers, and certainly not from the bureaucrats. Now, old Mayor Rothschild summed it up with a flair when he said, "You give me the money power, and I care not who makes the laws." Well, let me echo that by saying, "You give me the judicial power, and I care not who makes the laws either," because the real power in America is in our courts, not in our political process. Now, if you'd like to tap into this power of the courts, why don't you call us here at the law school? And be sure to ask for our free general law CD package. That number is 417-273-4967. Again, that's area code 417-273-4967 for that free general law CD package. That's a four-hour commentary on the law school. It's entertaining, it's educational, it's informative, and best of all, it's free of charge. Now, courtroom strategy and procedures available on compact disc for adult home education. If you're online, just go to the website. It's georgegordon.org. That's georgegordon.org. Click onto the email and send an email request for that free general law CD package. I want you to do it right now before you forget. Remember, georgegordon.org, or call direct 417-273-4967. All right, we've been talking about the 10 tribes of Israel. For those of you that may have tuned in for the first time, there are 10 lost tribes of Israel. You probably heard that in Sunday school or church at some point in time. And a fellow by the name of Stephen Collins did a little research into the Bible and into secular history and uncovered where those people are located. Now, he's not the first guy to do that. I mentioned before that a guy named J.H. Allen wrote a book back in 1907 called Judah's Scepter and Joseph's Birthright. A guy by the name of Herbert Armstrong back in the 50s or 60s wrote a book called The United States and British Commonwealth and Prophecy, which was a synopsis of Allen's work back in 1907. But I haven't seen any series of books or any, like Collins has written, or any other book that would hold a candle to this five-book series that Stephen Collins has written. So for the past week, I have mentioned that Collins has these five books. The way I got them is that I sent him a $100 bill, and he sent me the five books, and that's $20 a book, postage paid. And I thought that was a hell of a deal. And that's why I have mentioned to you that if you'll send that $100 bill to the author and just put a little note in there and tell him, "Hey, would you autograph those for me? I heard this on the Law Hour." I called Collins and I said, "I'm going to review your fifth book here pretty shortly." That was a couple, 3 months ago, and I just finally got around to it. I think he'll send you those five books. Now, if you want to order just one book, don't bother Collins, because he's not a book salesman. I just suggest to you that if you want the whole series, and I think that anybody who's interested in the Bible, interested in history or international geopolitics, will want all five books. And there's information in each one of these books that you've probably never heard before. At least that was the case with me. I'd never heard this before. And so I took a little time and I looked it up to find out, is this guy lying to me or not? And I find here in his bibliography and in his index that he has well documented his facts. Now, that's not to say that every word in here is gospel or that every word in here is true, accurate, and correct. There's probably some mistakes. I would go so far as to say that I've probably never read a book in my life that I agreed with 100% of the time, but I think this book here is probably very close to what I think is true, accurate, and correct based upon his documentation. This guy's name is Stephen Collins. I'll give you his name and address so that you can write to him if you so desire. 3901 Crescent Drive, Sioux Falls, South Dakota, 57106. Again, that's Stephen M. Collins. 3901 Crescent Drive, Sioux Falls, South Dakota, 57106. Now, if you just want to order one book at a time, the book we're reviewing this week is Israel's Tribes Today. It identifies the 10 tribes of Israel. Actually, there's 13 of them, but three of them we're not concerned about. 10 of them got lost, and Collins found them, so he wanted to tell you where they are today. And so far, we've discovered Ephraim in Great Britain, Manasseh in the United States, Reuben in France, Zebulun in Holland, Asher in South Africa, Issachar in Finland, Naphtali in Sweden, Benjamin in Norway, Dan in Denmark and Ireland, Gad in Germany, Austria and Switzerland, and Judah we are now discussing. So last time I had to break off, we ran out of time, and we were talking about the Jews. So if you want the rest of the story, go back to last night's broadcast, and that'll tell you the introduction to the Jews. And now we're talking about the Jews had been in a Caucasus region as a hospitable refuge for centuries. Now remember, the Caucasus Mountains are north of the Black Sea, north of Turkey, in a place called Russian Georgia, where Joe Stalin was born. You'll see the Caucasus Mountains coming down through there. And the Israelites, when they fled out of Iran and Iraq, out of the Babylonian and Assyrian captivity, they went north into the Caucasus Mountains. Why shouldn't they? Now, a number of Jews went up there too, and from 700 BC until at least the 5th century AD, it was inhabited by many descendants of the 10 tribes of Israel under names such as Scythians, Iberians, Saki, and Goths. Many of the Israelite kings were Jewish descendants of King David's dynasty. The Persian king Sapor II was from the Persian Sasanian kingdom that had driven the Parthians out of Asia. There had to be an immense number of Jews in the Transcaucasus region for him to take more than 75,000 Jews captive in a single raid into that area. Now, the Universal Jewish Encyclopedia continues the story by saying, quote, subsequently they, the Transcaucasian Jews, were joined by other Jews from more westerly regions from Asia Minor, the Crimean, and especially from the Byzantium, to escape from the severe persecutions which they had been suffering at the hands of Emperor Justinian in the 6th century AD. It is evident that Jewish immigration into the Caucasus took place not only at different times, but also from different directions. Now, we're not alone yet, and we're not done yet. Many Jews whose forefathers had lived peacefully under the Parthians finally migrated out of Persia centuries after the Parthians had done so. Now consider this account. From Arabic and other sources, primarily the old Persian chronicle Durbind Nima, we may conclude that many Jews migrated from North Persia and Mesopotamia to the northeast Caucasus during the 5th and 6th centuries under the Sassans, S-A-S, S-A-N-I-D-S, Sassanids, and other groups of immigrants followed. When in the 8th century the Arabs conquered part of Dagestan, they found a large Jewish population there. Now, in other words, many from the tribe of Judah migrated to the Caucasus Mountains from the old provinces formerly ruled by the Parthians, and they did so because the Sassanian persecution. Sassanian persecution was the same reason that the Parthians had fled the region centuries prior to that time. By the time the final waves of Parthian Jews entered the Transcaucasus, the descendants of the Parthians and Scythians were already occupying new homelands in Europe for many centuries before the Khazar rulers adopted Judaism. Now, there had been numerous migrations of the members of the tribe of Judah, known as Jews, into the region called Khazaria. Now, there would have been some remnants of the 10 tribes of Israel in that region as well. Indeed, Jewish sources claim that there were identifiable remnants from the tribes of Issachar, Manasseh, and Simeon living in Khazar regions, and that their archaic Hebrew names and the lack of any Levites among them supported the conclusion that they were not Jews, but Israelites from the 10 tribes of Israel. Since huge numbers of people from the 10 tribes of Israel had lived in or passed through this region from the 8th century B.C. until at least the 5th century A.D., some remnants of Israel's 10 tribes should be expected to be found there. However, this region had many non-Israelites as well. Now, the Encyclopedia Britannica tells us that the Khazars had reappeared in Armenia, though it was not until 625 AD that they appear as Khazars in the Byzantine annals, described as Turks from the east. The Transcaucasus was getting pretty crowded, and not only had numerous Jews lived in this region for centuries, coming from Judea and Parthia, but there were also Turks and other races, and even residual Israelites from the 10 tribes whose main body had migrated through this region on the way to Europe. Khazaria came to include not only portions of the Transcaucasus, but also part of the steppes north of the Black Sea-Caspian Sea region. And there's also evidence that most Khazars were of the Caucasian race. The Encyclopedia Britannica states that the Khazars were part of the white race of the steppe. And it adds that the Khazars, in response to being threatened by other Turkic tribes, such as the Petchens, built a stone fortress with the help of the Byzantines, and the Britannica adds, famous as the one stone structure in that stoneless region, the fortress, became known far and wide amongst the hordes of the steppe as Sarkel, or the White Abode. Merchants from every nation found protection and good faith in the Khazar cities. The dynasty accepted Judaism, but there was equal tolerance for all, and each man was held amenable to the official judges of his own faith. So the Khazars were known by their contemporaries as a white Caucasian race, and they built a great fortress to protect themselves from marauding Turkic tribes. And yet some of the Khazars were themselves called Turks. Now, they were capitalists. They were known for their good faith and to practice religious tolerance. In doing so, they perpetuated Parthian traditions. It was the Parthians who were famous for honest dealings and religious tolerance. And it's also evident that the entire nation of the Khazars did not adopt Judaism. The dynasty, the ruling class, adopted Judaism, while the commoners practiced either Judaism, Christianity, or Islam. The Universal Jewish Encyclopedia adds this comment on the Khazar conversion. It was chiefly due to the cultural superiority of the Dagestan Jews that the Kahan, the king, of the mighty state of the Khazars was converted to Judaism together with his court and part of the Khazar population between the 8th and 9th centuries. Now, this account indicates that besides the ruling class, only a part of the Khazar population adopted Judaism over the next century. Notice the title of the Khazar king, Kahan. The Hebrew word for priest is Kohen. The consonants of the Khazar's king's title with the Hebrew word for priests are identical, K-H-N. This indicates that the king of the Khazars, who already had a Hebrew title at the time of his conversion to Judaism, may have already been a racial member of the tribe of Judah or Levi. Why else would he already be known by the Jewish word for priest? Now, the Universal Jewish Encyclopedia also states that the conversion of the Khazar Kahan and his court may not have occurred until between 786 and 809 AD, and it further records how few people actually converted to Judaism as a result of their monarch's conversion, and it states regarding the Khazar king's conversion that he and about 4,000 Khazars were circumcised, and it was only by degrees that the Jewish teachings gained a foothold among the population. The Jews were greatly outnumbered by the pagan masses, by Muslim and Christian inhabitants of the cities. Now, the Khazars were not a majority Jewish state. They had leaders of the Jewish faith, but only a sizable minority of Jews among their numbers. A total of only 4,000 conversions to Judaism in a large nation was actually a small number of converts. The requirement of circumcision was likely a powerful disincentive for most Khazar men to convert to Judaism. Most Khazars remained in pagan or Christian religions, and in the latter centuries of the Khazar kingdom, many adopted Islam. And it is recorded that one of the major Khazar cities, Itel, had 30 mosques around 924 AD. Now, the Encyclopedia Britannica also lists the Khazars and the Ephlatites, the latter previously identified as the Israelite tribe of Naphtali, as being part of the white race of the steppe. If the Khazars and Ephelites were both recognized as tribes in the white race of the steppe, then the Khazars had to be a Semitic nation. However, stating the Khazars were Semitic still allows for them to include many ethnic groups, and we've seen evidence that many Khazars were descended from the tribes of Israel. Those numerous members were scattered throughout the region as they migrated over the centuries from Asia into Europe. However, the ancient Israelite empires of Scythia and Parthia had included many other racial and ethnic groups who were not of Israelite origin, and because of the region in which they were located, many of these other ethnic groups would also have had Semitic origins. These groups were also dislodged by the fall of the Scythian and Parthian empires, and their descendants would have been present in Khazaria as well. When word spread on the trade routes that Khazaria had adopted Judaism, Jews from the diaspora would surely have migrated to Khazaria to seek refuge there. According to the Universal Jewish Encyclopedia, the report of the marvelous conversion of the Khazar rulers spread throughout the Jewish world. This would have steadily increased the number of people from the tribe of Judah among the Khazars as more Jews migrated there for sanctuary and freedom of religion. When Khazaria fell, its people, including the Jews, would have been pushed toward Eastern Europe in various directions to seek refuge in new homelands. The Universal Jewish Encyclopedia records that the Jews of Khazaria migrated to Kiev and parts of Russia, while the remaining Khazars joined the Magyars and migrated to modern Hungary, becoming Christians. Now consider the traits of Judah, the son of Jacob, who gave his name to the tribe of Judah. When Joseph's brothers were about to kill him, Judah saw a way to make some money out of the situation. In Genesis 37, verse 26, it shows that he was the one who suggested that they sell Joseph as a slave with the words, "What profit is it if we slay our brother? Let us sell him." Judah had an appetite for financial matters that his brothers did not possess, albeit unprincipled in that particular instance. Judah was a quintessential capitalist who could turn most situations into money-making opportunities. Judah's original aptitude for making money has historically resulted in a strong Jewish presence in many banking, financial, and mercantile enterprises. Judah's descendants will be successful and prosperous in capitalist societies, and one would expect Judah's descendants to be prominent as bankers, financiers, retailers, and merchants. And since money begets power, one would also expect Jews to be prominent in governmental positions. Also, the Bible reveals that forefather Judah was very detail-oriented and had an aptitude for retaining knowledge and applying it to real-life situations. Judah had a very sharp mind. And many years after Joseph was sold into slavery by his brothers, Joseph was exalted by God to become regent of Egypt. Now, during a severe drought, Jacob sent 10 of his sons to buy food in Egypt, where they unknowingly encountered Joseph in a position of great authority. So Joseph tested them in a number of ways to determine their attitudes before deciding what to do with them and imposed conditions on their ability to return to Egypt for food. Some time passed. When the brothers prepared to make another trip to Egypt for food, it was Judah, and apparently only Judah, who reminded his father and brothers of the precise legal conditions binding on them if they returned to Egypt for more grain. You read that in Genesis 43, verses 1 through 5. So when Joseph's brothers returned to Egypt, they still were unaware that the Egyptian ruler that they were dealing with was their long-lost brother Joseph. So when Joseph was in a position to condemn or imprison his brothers, it was Judah who made such an impassioned speech to the Egyptian ruler, Joseph, for the lives of his family that it softened Joseph's heart. It literally moved Joseph to tears, and it prompted him to make himself known to his brothers in an act of reconciliation, as we read in Genesis 44, verses 14 through 45. Now, Judah's passionate, effective defense of himself and his brothers would have been the envy of any attorney. The trait of thinking in a precise legalistic manner has been apparent throughout the history of the Jews. After the captivity of Judah, the Jews built a wall of extra rules around God's laws to prevent them from being broken. However, they went to legalistic extremes, and Jesus Christ indicated that the Pharisees' legalism as obscuring the wisdom and the love of God's original Torah laws. Only the tribe of Judah would develop volumes and volumes of religious regulations and commentary into the modern Talmud. Judah's detailed legalistic nature also served a very great purpose. The Apostle Paul wrote that God relied on the Jews to preserve the books of the Bible in Romans 3, verses 1 and 2. The New Testament, except for Luke's Gospel and the book of Acts, was written exclusively by Jews, as was most of the Old Testament. A legalistic approach, prizing precise wording and narrative accuracy, is ideal for writing and preserving books that are intended to be kept for future generations. The innate legalism of the tribe of Judah was best suited to preserve God's scriptures. No other Israelite tribe possessed the same ability to preserve laws, customs, and traditions over millennia. And indeed, the other tribes of Israel not only forgot many of the laws of God over time, they even forgot their own Israelite ancestry. If God had given the Bible to any other tribe to preserve it, we would likely have no Bible at all today. Today, a predisposition for legalistic, detailed thinking will result in many Jews being present in the legal profession and any other profession involving precise reasoning skills, such as science, research, academics, and accounting. And if you look at the Nobel Prize winners, you will find that there is a predominance of Jewish recipients. By many criteria, modern Jews exhibit the characteristics of their ancestor Judah. Let us now examine the rest of the prophecy of Genesis 49, verses 8 through 12, which foretells Judah's role in the last days. Judah, thou art he whom thy brethren shall praise. Thy hand shall be in the neck of thy enemies. Thy father's children shall bow down before thee. Judah is a lion's whelp. From the prey, my son, thou art gone up. Genesis 49, 8 through 12. Now Judah is depicted as a warlike nation in the latter days. The Israelis have been militarily successful in their Mideast wars, fulfilling this prophecy that they will be like a lion killing its prey. It is only since the founding of a Jewish state in 1948 that the ancient warring skills of Judah have again been made evident. Since there was no independent Jewish nation to wage wars on anyone from ancient times until 1948, this prophecy could not have been fulfilled until modern times, when a Jewish nation existed, further identifying the post-World War II period as the last days. At the beginning of this chapter, the prophecy of Zephaniah 2 verse 7 was cited, which foretold, quote, "And the coast shall be for the remnant of the house of Judah. They shall feed thereupon, in the houses of Ashkelon they shall lie down, and the Lord their God shall visit them and turn away their captivity." Now this prophecy is set in a time just prior to the day of the Lord's anger, paralleling the day of the Lord, which is associated in prophecies with the latter days. Ashkelon was an old Philistine city on the Palestinian seacoast, so the Bible accurately predicted a Jewish homeland would be restored on the coastal portion of Palestine in the latter days, ending the captivity or the stateless diaspora of the Jews. The founding of the Jewish state in 1948 fulfilled the ancient prophecy, which predicted the Jewish captivity of diaspora would not be ended until just prior to the day of the Lord. Zephaniah's prophecy refers to the Jews as the remnant of the house of Judah, without mentioning Israel. Biblical prophecies refer to the modern tribes of Israel by their ancient names, not their modern names. In terms of understanding prophecy, the name of the modern Jewish state is misleading. Even though the Israeli nation is located in the ancient land of Israel, it was founded by the descendants of the kingdom and the tribe of Judah. That God in 1948 used the Jewish people to fulfill a latter-day prophecy is irrefutable evidence that the modern Jews are Judah. That the tribe of Judah is likened to a lion in the end time indicates that they will be bold, even predatory in their military approach. Surrounded by enemies during their first decades of existence, the Israelis had to be a martial nation. In the Arab-Israeli wars, we have seen in their daring rescue raid at Entebbe, the preemptive strike on Iraq's nuclear reactor, and other bold heroics, that the Jews have clearly fulfilled this aspect of Jacob's prophecy about Judah. When the Bible uses the term Israel in latter-day prophecies, it usually refers to the modern nations of the 10 tribes of Israel. Now, Genesis 49's prophecy for the latter days refers to Judah as a lion's whelp. Latter-day Judah is likened to a very young lion, a cub. A cub is both young and small. In other words, the tribe of Judah will be both a young and small nation in the latter days, and this prophecy has been precisely fulfilled in the modern Israeli nation in the Middle East. It is young, having come into existence in 1948, and it is also small, having a very limited geographical area. All right, we got to take our break. That's the end of the Judah story. Hang on, we'll give you a reminder, and then we'll be back with the last two, Levi and Simeon. So we're going to put Judah down here for Israel. Next week, we'll take you on a little journey, and we'll take a look at this Khazar kingdom over here and the whole concept that's been espoused here concerning Israel and Judah. And we'll take a look at Esau. We have an Uncle Esau over here that we need to look at that hasn't been covered here in Stephen M. Collins' books, and I'll do that at another time. Now, you're listening to The Law Hour and Editorial Review, sponsored by the Gordon Law School of Isabella, Missouri. The Law Hour is heard 7 days a week here in the United States and worldwide over the Internet. For more information about the Law School and the Law Hour, please go to our website at georgegordon.org. The Law School teaches family law, tax law, courtroom strategy and procedure, business law, agricultural law, civil rights, and biblical law from the scriptural perspective. The Law School is a private, non-commercial, non-profit, non-sectarian law school, and it is open to individuals by prearrangement. The Law School conducts a homeschooling program for adults on compact disc. For more information, just go to our homeschooling page on the website at georgegordon.org. The Law Hour website is updated every week. It has our radio log schedule and archives, and it can be accessed through the website at georgegordon.org. The Law Hour is carried worldwide over the Internet. All of these Law Hour programs are archived on the Internet by title and date. The Law Hour is an educational service brought to you in the public interest. The Law Hour brings you timely reports on law, science, education, politics, religion, economics, history, health, news, and current events 7 days a week. The Law School offers a free 4-hour introductory CD package. To order yours, please call the Law School at 417-273-4967. Again, that's area code 417-273-4967. Now, the sources of information that we use on this program are true, accurate, and correct to the best of our knowledge and belief. The Law Hour and Editorial Review gives credit to those authors and publications that we use on this program, and we often endorse and recommend books, periodicals, papers, and newsletters to our listeners. The endorsements or recommendations that we give do not mean that those authors or publications so endorsed or recommended will reciprocate. And most of the authors and publications that we cite on the Law Hour are political, religious, economic, sectarian, racial, or ethnic partisans whose viewpoint is not necessarily endorsed by the Law Hour and Editorial Review. The opinions, beliefs, comments, views, and expressions that you hear on this program are mine and mine alone. They do not necessarily represent the beliefs and opinions of the advertisers, the sponsors, the management, or the staff of this network or of this local radio station. For more information about the Law Hour and Editorial Review, please go to our website. Remember, that's georgegordon.org, or you can call direct 417-273-4967. All right, we are reviewing Israel's Tribes today by Stephen M. Collins. You can get a copy of the book from Bible Blessings. They've also got a webpage. It's BibleBlessings.net. If you want to go to the website, BibleBlessings, all one word, .net. Bible Blessings is the name of the publishing house. They're located at Post Office Box 1778, Royal Oak, Michigan, 48068. Again, that's P.O. Box 1778, Royal Oak, Michigan, 48068. If you want to order one copy, at a time, go to the publisher. If you'd like to get all five books in the series, I recommend that you send a $100 bill to Stephen Collins, 3901 Crescent Drive, Sioux Falls, South Dakota, 57106. Again, that's Stephen M. Collins, 3901 Crescent Drive, Sioux Falls, South Dakota, 57106. Can anything good come out of South Dakota? There's one thing that I know of these five books, and I've recommended them very highly to my listeners and to my students, because as a matter of law, a good understanding of the Scripture is essential, and a good understanding of the history of the Scripture is just a giant step forward. It's a giant leap up. Can't tell you how important these five books are. Now we have the last two tribes, Levi and Simeon. These are called scattered warriors. And these tribes are discussed last in this chapter because the Bible indicated that they would not have nations of their own in the latter days, but that they would be scattered among the other tribes of Israel. Since Genesis 49, verses 5 through 7 addresses them jointly, they will be discussed together in this book jointly, and the Bible's prophecy for them is this. Simeon and Levi are brothers. Weapons of violence are their swords. O my soul, come not into their counsel. O my spirit, be not joined to their company. For in their anger they slay men, and in their wantonness they hamstring oxen. Cursed be their anger, for it is fierce, and their wrath, for it is cruel. I will divide them in Jacob and scatter them in Israel. The reference to oxen is more understandable in the Living Bible, which states that Levi and Simeon maimed oxen just for fun. The reference to their killing men concerns the events of Genesis chapter 34, wherein Simeon and Levi massacred all of the males of a town because one of them had premarital sex with their sister Dinah, even though Dinah had apparently consented to the act. Now, the reference to maiming oxen and wantonly killing men indicates both of them had a propensity for violence. In modern English, we would say that Levi and Simeon had a tendency to shoot first and ask questions later. Genesis 49's prophecy implies that if God had allowed these tribes to be sovereign nations in the latter days, that they would be ruthless, militaristic nations. Since their descendants are scattered among the other tribes of Israel in the last days, they will likely be found among the more nationalistic and patriotic, some would say redneck. At least, some would say, the redneck regions of each of the modern nations of Israel, and their inclination to war and a tolerance for violence and violent situations would surely draw many of them into the military or police services of the modern Israelite nations. The Bible's account of Joseph meeting his brothers who had sold him into slavery in Egypt records Joseph's harshest treatment was given to Simeon. He let Simeon languish in an Egyptian prison while the others were permitted to return to Canaan. We read that in Genesis 42, verse 24. So this indicates that Joseph recalled Simeon as the leader of the effort to kill him before he was sold into slavery, in Genesis 37, verses 18 through 20. Simeon had some good qualities as well. After the Israelites split into warring nations, there was a time when Israel had forsaken God, but Judah had several good kings. And during this period of time, various members of the northern 10 tribes of Israel moved to Judah in order to serve God, as we see in 2 Chronicles 15, verse 9, and 2 Chronicles 34, verse 6. They both mention that on two different occasions, it was the Simeonites who were prominent in joining people from the tribes of Ephraim and Manasseh to serve God and keep His commandments. This indicates that the Simeonites can exhibit a real zeal for God and may also tend to be found in the Bible belts of the nations of the modern tribes of Israel. Since the Simeonites are mentioned as acting in concert with Ephraim and Manasseh in both of the above passages, it implies that the modern Simeonites will be found in significant numbers among the modern tribes of Ephraim and Manasseh. There is a historical record that the Simeoni arrived in ancient Britain in 720 BC when many Israelites were fleeing from Assyrian captivity. These Simeoni were a part of the tribe of Simeon that fled to the British Isles, a well-established colony of ancient Israel. Their Celtic descendants were fierce warriors and successfully limited Roman advances into the British Isles, that neither the Romans nor the Saxons were able entirely to subdue the native Celts gives evidence to the innate military prowess of the Celts. This would be expected of the Simeonites. Now, the Celts were eventually pushed westward into Wales and southward into Scotland. Therefore, those with Welsh and Scots ancestry would be prime candidates for Simeonite ancestry in the modern world. While Genesis 49 prophesied that the Simeonites would not have a nation of their own in the latter days, it did not state that they would never be sovereign at any time in their history. In fact, there is evidence that the Simeonites at one time did have a famous sovereign of their own. We saw earlier that the Danites were part of the ancient sea peoples who marauded in the western Mediterranean from 1400 BC to about 1200 BC. The Greeks recorded that besides the Danans, at least one other tribe, the Sicarii, was allied to the Danans at that time. The name of Isaac indicates that this other tribe was an unnamed Israelite tribe. A marauding, warlike way of life would be consistent with either the Simeonites or the Levites, but the Simeonites were most likely a sea people, a tribe as the Levites were then occupied as the priestly tribe of Israel. The fact that the Danites and the Simeonites sailed together to the British Isles in 720 BC as the Tuatha de Dananan and the Simeoni supports the view that these two tribes were also sailing together as the sea people during the time of Israel's judges. In the first book of this series, evidence was presented that some Danites and other Israelites in the sea peoples settled portions of ancient Greece. And there is strong evidence that the Spartans were descended from Israelite sea peoples who had found a homeland in ancient Greece. Supporting this proposal is a record that the Spartan Greeks mingled with the sea peoples who had settled in Libya. Sparta had an interest in helping Carthage, identified in the second book of this series as an Israelite empire outpost. During the Punic Wars, it was the Spartans who reorganized and revitalized the Carthaginian army so that it would better fight the Romans. Now, why would Sparta aid Carthage unless it recognized a tribal link to the Carthaginians? Interestingly enough, when Sparta established a colony of its own in Italy, it named it Taras. Terra is a name associated with Israelites when they were wandering in the wilderness, Numbers 33, verses 27 and 28. And Terah was a father of Abraham, as we see in Genesis 11, verse 31. The second book in this series presented evidence that the seafaring Milesians who eventually migrated into Ireland were mostly Simeonites. That discussion noted that most of the Simeonites and portions of other tribes left the main Israelite column during their wandering in the wilderness with Moses and struck out on their own. One of the famous cities of ancient Ireland was also called Tara, T-A-R-A. Much stronger evidence of an Israelite origin for Sparta is found in the testimony of the Spartans themselves. In the book of 1 Maccabees, it contains a fascinating correspondence between the Jews and the Spartans in the 2nd century B.C. In the time of the Maccabees' revolt from the Seleucids, a Jewish leader, Jonathan, sent a letter to the Spartans that included the following statement, quote, "Jonathan the high priest and the rest of the Jewish people send greetings to their brothers the Spartans. In former times, a letter was sent to the high priest of Onias from Arius, who was then a king among you, to say that you are our kinsmen. As a copy of it that is appended to this shows, we have undertaken to send to renew relations of brotherhood with you, as it is right and proper to remember kinsmen." Unquote. It is remarkable, and it is a remarkable piece of historical evidence that the Jews regarded the Spartans as kinsmen. Israelites from a related tribe. The above letter is found in 1 Maccabees 12, verses 5 through 18. And verses 19 through 23 record this passage from the letter of King Arius of Sparta in response to the first letter back to the Jews. It says, quote, "Arius, king of the Spartans, sends greetings to Onias, the chief priest. It has been found in a writing concerning the Spartans and Jews that they are kinsmen, and they are descended from Abraham. Now, since we learned this, please write us about your welfare." Unquote. A king, Arius the First, ruled in Sparta around 309 to 264 B.C., as did a king Arius II around 259 to 251 B.C., one of whom wrote the original letter to the Jewish high priest. Notice that the Spartan king does not claim the Spartans are Jews, but rather claims that they are kinsmen of the Jews. Now, this is an appropriate wording, because if the Spartans were descended from one of the other tribes of Israel, they were not Jews. Josephus, regarded the above correspondence as genuine and referred to it in his work. Historian A. H. M. Jones also cites this correspondence in his book titled Sparta. The Scythians, identified as descendants of the 10 tribes of Israel, also looked to the Spartans as allies, and they proposed a military alliance with them. These ancient writings and connections between the Spartans, the Jews, the Carthaginians, and the Scythians suggest that for many centuries after the kingdom of Israel and Judah went into captivity, the tribes of Israel still knew where their scattered kinsmen were located. Sparta was a warlike city-state, and its martial culture testified to an origin that differed from the other Greek city-states. And the Encyclopedia Britannica observes, quote, "The whole education of the Spartan was designed to make him an efficient soldier. Obedience, endurance, military success, these were the aims constantly kept in view, and all other ends took a secondary place." A martial nature identifies the tribe of Simeon, which had a natural inclination to go to war. We see that in Genesis 35, verses 25 and 26, and in Genesis 49, verses 5 and 6. The Simeonites were pure warriors who excel in the arts of war. It was Spartan King Leonidas and his 300 Spartans who valiantly saved Greece by holding the pass at Thermopylae against the immense army of Persians, or Persia's King Xerxes. If the above identifications are accurate, a mere 300 Simeonite warriors held back the entire Persian Empire in this famous battle, at least long enough for the Greeks to gather the rest of their forces. And that gallant and self-sacrificial battle may have been one of the Simeonites' finest hours. The strong military skills of the early British Celts and the Spartans indicate that they were, in fact, Simeonites. If God had allowed those Simeonites to have a nation of their own in modern times, rather than scattering them, it would likely have exhibited the martial character of ancient Sparta. So let us consider now the Levites. They were originally given 48 independent cities to live in when the Israelites divided Canaan. We see that in Joshua chapter 21. The Levites were the priestly tribe of Israel, and it was they who killed and dismembered the myriads of animals in ancient Israel in the sacrificial system. So when Jeroboam I of Israel rejected God's laws, many of the Levites moved in mass into the kingdom of Judah, as we see in 2 Chronicles 11, verses 13 through 17. And during biblical times, the tribe of Levi was affiliated most closely with the Jews, not the Israelites. Many Levites were affiliated with the Jews in Asia, as some of them accompanied the Jews who rebuilt Jerusalem during the time of Ezra and Nehemiah, as we see in Ezra 1 verse 5 and Nehemiah 7 verses 39 through 45. Most of the Levites remained in the Parthian Empire, where some of them may have been the hereditary priesthood who formed Parthia's Magi. And together, the Levites are scattered among both Jews and the nations of the 10 tribes of Israel. Although the Levites shared the Simeonites' capacity for violence, they had a particular zeal for service to God, which was apparent in the Bible. In Exodus 32, it records that the Israelites sinned with the golden calf at Mount Sinai while Moses was on the mountain with God. When Moses returned, he found the Israelites engaged in an idolatrous orgy. Moses asked for those on the Lord's sides to come to him, and the entire tribe of Levi came to Moses. Moses immediately assigned the Levites the job of executing the Israelite ringleaders of this idolatrous event. We read that in Exodus 32, verses 25 through 28. The Levites, it is recorded, quickly killed 3,000 fellow Israelites. The combination of an inclination towards violence and a zeal for God made the Levites the perfect choice to be the priestly tribe of ancient Israel, because so much of their responsibilities involved killing and butchering animal sacrifices. They were, in effect, the civil service of the nation. And like Simeonites, the Levites are not squeamish people, and they would make excellent surgeons, soldiers, and morticians. An interesting passage in Jeremiah 33, verses 17 through 22, contains God's promise that David's descendants will perpetually rule over the house of Israel, and that the Levites will perpetually be involved in priestly service. Verse 22 also promises that both David and the Levites will be blessed with numerous descendants. It was proposed earlier that Levites may have constituted the Parthian Magi, who were a hereditary priesthood. And supporting this conclusion is the fact that God himself personally interacted with Parthia's Magi to bring them to Judea to worship Jesus as a young child. Biblical precedent shows that God did not work hand in glove with pagan priesthoods. In 70 AD, the Jerusalem temple was destroyed and the need for a Levitical priesthood became moot. There are now no animal sacrifices to offer, but Jeremiah 33, verses 17 through 22 promises that the Levites would always be priests of God. So where are they today? Well, given the traditional Levite zeal for God, it is logical that modern Levites will be found among Jewish rabbis and Christian pastors. God prophesied that he would scatter the Levites among all the tribes of Israel, not just among the Jews. In so doing, God provided Levites to minister to all of Israel's tribes. The Levites also had a special aptitude for music and entertainment. In 1 Chronicles 15, verses 14 through 28, and in 2 Chronicles 5, verses 12 and 13, show that the Levites served as the official singers and musicians in ancient Israel. In 1 Chronicles 15, verses 16 through 22, we learn that, quote, David spoke to the chief of the Levites to appoint their brethren to be the singers with instruments of music, psalteries, and harps and cymbals. The chief of the Levites instructed about the song because he was skillful. Now, these passages show that in Israel's temple services, the orchestra and the choir were Levites, with the chief Levite serving as the choir director. In Ezra 3, verse 10, and Nehemiah 7, verse 44, confirmed that the Levites continued to perform these functions for centuries. The clear indication is that one clan of Levites possessed superior musical, artistic, and creative skills. Consequently, we should expect to find many Levites in the music and entertainment business today because of Levi's historically dominant affiliation with the tribe of Judah. One would expect that many Jews in today's music, entertainment, and movie industries are actually Levites because of the artistic and creative talents of their father Levi. However, since the Bible prophesied that the Levites would be scattered among all of the tribes of modern Israel, many non-Jews with particularly strong artistic, musical, or creative skills may also be Levites. Well, that concludes my analysis, or my review of Israel's tribes today. Remember, this book is written by Stephen M. Collins. It's the fifth in a series of books that he has written on the origin and the history, the empires, the travels of, the expansion of the tribes of Israel, all 13 of them. So, Levi and Simeon, the last two, number 12 and 13, are scattered. Now, let me give you the name and address one more time. This guy's name is Stephen M. Collins, 3901 Crescent Drive, Sioux Falls, South Dakota. The zip code 57106. My suggestion, send that guy a $100 bill and tell him you want all five of the books in the series. That'll be $20 a piece, and he sent them to me postpaid. That address again, Stephen M. Collins, 3901 Crescent Drive, Sioux Falls, South Dakota, 57106. If you just want to order one book at a time, then go to the publisher. It's BibleBlessings.net. Just go to the internet, BibleBlessings, all one word, .net. I don't know what the price is going to be from the publisher. You'll have to call them and ask, but they are the publisher is called Bible Blessings, P.O. Box 1778, Royal Oak, Michigan, 48068. Again, that's Bible Blessings, Post Office Box 1778, Royal Oak, Michigan, 48068. All right, next time we'll take up this thing of Judah and the Khazars, and I'll share with you a little more information upon that subject that Stephen Collins did not cover. We'll do that next week, and that'll be a little bonus. I'm about out of time, so let me give you a final reminder that you're listening to The Law Hour, an editorial review sponsored by the Gordon Law School of Isabella, Missouri. The Law Hour is heard 7 days a week here in the United States, worldwide over the Internet. For more information about the law school and The Law Hour, please go to our website. Remember, that's georgegordon.org. Now, the law school is a private, non-commercial, non-profit, non-sectarian law school and is open to individuals by prearrangement. The Law Hour is carried worldwide on the Internet, and all of these Law Hour programs are archived on the Internet by title and date for your listening convenience. Time's up. I got to leave it right there. We'll see you back here tomorrow night. Same time, same station, God willing, of course. So until then, thanks for listening, and good night, friends.